to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
If you're drowning and I throw you a life jacket, would you grab it? Yes, good. Pick up 200 shares. I won't let you down.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
Ask them how they'd like to see 30, 40% returns. What are they going to say? No? I don't want to see those returns.
Where's the money, Lebowski?
You're going to make a lot of money, right?
Be aggressive. Learn how to push.
Show him a 3% return, and I'll trust you to watch his kids for the weekend.
I'm a big fan of money.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I did not know this.
That's it. I'm done.
Well, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tamal. We have Matt Byrne on the board. S&P futures up 39. NASDAQ futures up 264 as we're trying to start the new year to the upside after three slip days in a row. We'll see how that works out. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Hey, good morning. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you. Happy bleeping New Year.
Happy bleeping New Year.
Yes. So, how was your New Year's?
I got my monthly trip to the emergency room out of the way on the first of the month.
What'd you do? Slip on the ice like an old dude?
No. On Wednesday, I noticed this really kind of oddball little growth on the temple area of my the left side of my head, and it was just like something's in there, and it grew larger on Thursday. So I said, well, damn, I better go in and have somebody look at it.
Maybe it was a worm.
No, it's actually a something called giant cell arteritis. It's basically the artery that runs through your head was swelling up, and it could be dangerous if it starts to affect your eyesight. In fact, there have been instances of permanent blindness, but it's a quick catch, and I'm getting treated. So,
well, don't fall on your head and land on it and have it blow up.
And actually, they gave me the treatment is steroids, and they gave me the first dose yesterday. I have to pick up the prescription. It's already started to shrink. So,
well, why don't you rush to the gym while you're taking the roids?
Yeah, that's what I want to do. As long as the arteries, kind of in a tender state, I might as well pump some blood really well through it. And
pump you up. Happens. Pump you up. What was that movie? Arnold.
it was Saturday Night Live skit.
Yeah.
After the Pumping Iron movie, yeah.
God.
You asked how New Year's was? I spent a couple hours over at the ER and then came home.
Well, as long as it was only a couple, that's a pretty good ER.
Yeah, that wasn't bad. I've learned, because I've been there so many times in the last year, for whether it was my throat swelling closed or blood clots flaring up or anything. I've learned that you have to pack as if they're going to admit you. So
why do you just out of curiosity? Here, people usually make the first trip to the urgent care center, and they kind of let you know whether you need to go further than that. I mean, do you have one of those around there? But what's the interplay between those two?
Yeah, and in fact, when I had the blood clot issue, that's exactly what I did. But I knew that all they would do is they would send me over, because this, it wound up not needing a CT scan either. But I was just figuring, first of all, I immediately start thinking of, what could this be? Well, didn't think it was a tumor, because a tumor wouldn't just show up one day and then double in size the next. So I didn't think it was that. I was worried about aneurysm. So that, that was my big concern, and I didn't want to screw around with a stop at the walk-in clinic, which is about three blocks from the hospital and the emergency room anyway, because I knew that they would probably just send me over there anyhow.
Well, anytime you get to walk out and not get me brought in, it's a good day, I guess.
Yeah, so anyway, the answer to your question is yes, there's a walk-in clinic, and yes, I'm inclined to use that first, because that's the appropriate use of the healthcare system, such as it is, the ER is more expensive. But in this case, I did have a concern that this could quickly become a life-threatening issue. So
I was part of a major brawl one night at some bar.
Was I involved in that?
No, this is about as dumb as it gets, but one of the guys was ended up getting cut on his temple, and the blood kind of pours out of there. If you've ever seen that, there just happened to be at the time a hospital which no longer there. That they brought him into the hospital and they kept him overnight because they said if you get a blood clot there, you're screwed. This was probably one of the dumbest things I've ever seen. And of course, it was an amazing performance by the Chicago police. They had this, not much going on today except the market is up. Might as well tell this quick story. There's this big charity event at Chicago Stadium before the new place, right? So I had stopped playing basketball like a couple years before. I played a real lot. And so they said, hey, how would you like to sponsor a team? And we had, we're doing pretty good at the time. We had a bunch of traders. So I sponsor a team. I go, I'll just be an alternate, guys. it's been a long time since I played. Matter of fact, when I walked out on the floor, I said, the last time I played, there was no three-point line, so that was a while ago. So we get this pretty good team. One of the guys is on our team, Bobby Bades, real good ball player. Well, it's 4-on-4, like they got a bunch of courts set up on the stadium. And, those kinds of things, aren't any refs, all he does is hack you when you go in. Anyway, about three points in their first game, Bobby hurts his ankle. Right, so I'm in. Well, we win the first game, so that means it's a 2-0, you got to lose two before it's a double elimination. We win the first game, then we lose one, then we lose one. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm already starting to stiffen up. This is 8 in the morning. And, now other teams that are moving onward are getting guys getting hurt. Imagine that at that age. I'm saying we're in our 30s, but nobody, we weren't in our 20s.
Only games are ball.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't really, but there were some pretty good players. And so everybody starts grabbing me to play on their team because I'm one of the few guys that's still allegedly healthy, right? So we get to the championship game. It's now 5 o'clock. I've played like 10 of these games, and I'm dying. And so the guy I'm playing against is a dude who just graduated from Illinois on their basketball team like 6 months before. And I go, here's the deal. Shoot from the outside. Don't embarrass me, and I won't hack you. And the guy goes, okay, I'll take that deal. what am I supposed to do with this guy? He's 15 years younger. He's 2 inches taller, and he's faster than I ever was. I'm like, what exactly am I supposed to do? I'm not going to hack him. So what am I? I'm not going to let him just run around me either. So I made the deal with him. I don't know if that's a good idea or not, Kevin. What do you think?
Not exactly, sport competitive, but it might be a good survivalist scheme.
We had no chance. We lost 15-10. It was okay. We had zero chance. There wouldn't have been a line. Let's put it that way. Just saying.
Okay.
But my name was up on the board in the Chicago Stadium as being in the last team, the championship team. I only played one game with them because all the other guys got hurt.
Get a picture.
I do have one somewhere. I don't know where the hell it is. They had the starting. Remember that really old stadium scoreboard where the clocks went the other way?
Oh yeah,
The
hockey clocks. Yeah.
So I don't know why I'm so happy that this Ole Miss guy, who was coached for 2 weeks, beat the Georgia guy.
You know what? Lane Kiffin has made $500,000 so far based on his old team.
Really?
Yeah.
How does that work?
His LSU contract pays him a bonus for each game that Ole Miss wins in this year's playoff.
Why is that?
I read that it happened. I didn't read why, but I assume it's because he had that bonus in his his Ole Miss contract, and he was walking away from it. So I would guess that it was making him whole on that bonus just for this year.
There are professional leagues, like maybe Major League Baseball, that ban anything like that.
Well, common sense would say so, but common sense doesn't apply to anything NCAA. So,
although
I have read that a lot of schools now are starting, this is what I've been advocating for a while, they're starting to get term contracts for their athletes' NIL money.
Well, we've been talking about that since the day it started, right? I mean, you can't just all be one way.
Yeah, if you want to get paid, then you can't walk away from me after the first year. So, or the second year, or the whatever year, So I think that's just that's a more sensible approach. A lot of coaches have been out advocating for, bringing back the sit out for a year for transfers, but that won't fly because it got nailed in court. So, they can't overrule the court judgment. So it only makes sense to me that, the thing to do is, I'll pay you, but, it's going to be a two-year deal or a three-year deal or whatever kind of deal we're going to do. Or it's going to be even a four-year deal if you want to if the guy really wants it, is going to get paid a whole lot of money. And the only way you can legally void it is to go to the NFL.
Which way do you think it's going to go? And I say that I see two possible directions there. One is if somebody signs a four-year contract for the NIL stuff, and he either has to pay some of it back if he leaves, or the new team has to compensate the old team. Which way do you think it's going to go?
I tend to guess it's going to go more to the player having to...
Well, because there's no... It's not like Major League Baseball where you can...
It's not so much a pay it back as it is a situation where, you may hold some of it in escrow or something like that.
Well, I guess Major League Baseball, because it's the ridiculous monopoly, and I don't know how football and basketball decide to pile in. Lou says once you got somebody over a barrel that bad and you make a contract with them, then the contract is sound. I guess he's right. In fact, I know he's right, but I don't approve of it. But the idea of making a trade, I mean, there's no other walk of life can you make a trade with somebody. If you've got a four-year contract with Arthur Young and I'm, one of the other accounting firms, I can't trade for you. I mean, that's almost like...
It'd be interesting to see if college football, they start doing that, though.
Well, I mean, but I'm saying, so it's going to go the other way. The guy just can't move. He's got a contract, or he has to pay. There's got to be some out to the thing.
Well, but that's the same thing. If you sign an employment contract, you may be restricted in how you can move on that. In fact, when I have signed employment contracts in the past, that has always been a sticking point for me. In fact, I remember going over one with the HR director, and she said, we're going to sit down and talk to the president and talk to your boss about it. And there's this one non-compete clause in there, and he looked at her when I was saying, no, I want this modified. He looked at her and said, does my contract say that? And she said, yes, it does. He said, we're going to have to talk about that.
God. Well, I mean, it's interesting when you're talking about 19-year-old kid. Well, anybody, really. But if you're paying some kid at some place and he doesn't think he's going to start, and he wants to go somewhere else, and you don't want to let him out, whether or not he performs like you want him, you almost don't want to pay him if he doesn't want to be there, yet you want some kind of return for what you've invested in him if he goes somewhere else. I mean, how do you fix that? I mean, because that's really what I think describes the quandary, doesn't it?
You may be right in that the receiving school may have to buy out the contract. Is that really all that different than Lane Kiffin getting a bonus for his former team's employer make him whole? Now they're not giving anything to Ole Miss. They're giving it to Kiffin, but Ole Miss on the other hand is not paying out that bonus because he's not there.
How do you pay somebody half a million bucks?
Sort of a once removed type of situation there.
How do you pay somebody that kind of money if he's not even working for you? I don't know. I guess he's...
Yeah, well, they're not.
Well, I guess the fine line here, and, where's Lou when we need him? The fine line is if it goes the way you're saying, which I think probably it will, then instead of the team initiating the trade, then the kid is going to say, I really want to go, and the other school wants me bad enough to give you guys 200 grand or something. It looks like that's going to be the way it plays out. Doesn't it?
That wouldn't surprise me.
Well, and I guess I don't know if somebody takes a chance and, some kid who's 6'4", 190, and he looks like he's got a pretty big frame, and you bring him into, wherever, and all of a sudden, you got a nice program, and the kid just fills out. That's what happens to people. And all of a sudden, he gets on a pretty decent strength program, which, people used to fill out before there were strength programs. And all of a sudden, the guy grows an inch or two in college, like some people don't. And wasn't Orlando Woolridge? He was like 6'3", and he was recruited to Notre Dame as a guard. And the guy grew like, what, 4 inches that summer before he showed up as a freshman. They like said, "Who are you?" Right? Something along those lines. I mean, that can happen. And all of a sudden, you know, the likes of LSU wants to pay the kid a bunch of dough after he's played for you for 2 years, and all of a sudden he's a stud cake. I don't know why you shouldn't get some of that money back if he never really, you know, maybe he never even got in a game yet, or maybe he played two games or something. Why shouldn't you get some of that?
Well, you got to ask if the developmental guy is going to be a guy that you're going to commit to a multi-year deal.
Well, you would if you're Miami of Ohio or someplace.
Well, you might, yeah. If you're from a really low achieving program that doesn't accomplish much, like say Alabama,
yeah.
By the way, did I not say back when they were we were bitching about the selection committee that this year's Notre Dame team is better than and Miami's too, and Miami and Notre Dame, that they are both better than the fourth and the fifth place SEC teams, not just this year. This year's version of Miami and this year's version of Notre Dame are better than the fourth and fifth place SEC teams any year in any era. So, and hasn't that proven to be true? Because Alabama got curb stomped yesterday. They are the fifth place SEC team, and their win last time was against the fourth place SEC team. In fact, the SEC in this playoff has only beaten other SEC teams.
Well, their argument, you know, whether it's
not a good one, whatever you want to say.
No, I you have to, in order to do what you want to do, okay, which is to pick some of the best teams at the end of the year, the whole psychology has to change, and I don't see that changing. I mean, clearly, especially in the days of two things have happened. One is NIL and the portal. I'm combining those as one thing, and the other is we're playing one hell of a lot more games. So you could have a team that drags, say, Memphis, 70 new players, as the team wears on. It's nothing like 15 years ago, where you start is where you finish. I mean, some of these teams can get, and it also affects teams like Notre Dame that still try and do something. And they're not the only one. It's still try and go through the recruitment, high school kids, and all of a sudden the sophomore starts his first game and he's a piece of crap, and by the end of the year he's a stud. I mean, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to be like almost like NCAA basketball, where they don't really care if you've got four losses your first four games of the year against good teams. As long as at the end of the year you look pretty damn good, you're in. The records mean something, but not a lot. It's what you've done for me lately. Plus, if the SEC
you're making the argument against Alabama.
Exactly right. But I'm saying it's a whole different mentality. Now, the SEC's mentality is, and I can see where they come from, we're gonna have people playing 5 and 6 quality games a year. And oh, by the way, there's gonna be a championship playoff and blah blah. I'm zero fan of Alabama. But those guys have played 4 or 5 pretty high tense games in the last 5 games. And all of a sudden now you're missing 3-4 people on the O-line and other places. These teams can degrade. It's almost like pro now. So I'm saying these all these variables.
You say that in the last 5 games. That's not true about Alabama. They played one intense game where Georgia beat the crap out of them. The week before, they barely escaped against Auburn, which you could call an intense game, but Auburn was a team with a losing record who had already fired their coach.
What I'm saying is,
week before that, they played Eastern Illinois. So they have not played 4 or 5 intense games.
I know your hatred of Alabama is running through this.
No. It's not my hatred of Alabama. I have nothing against Alabama other than the fact that they didn't belong in the field this year.
Okay. They're
one of the blue bloods. They've been around forever, and I have a lot of respect for what they did, especially under Saban.
Do you have any idea how hard it is to agree with a Stacks and Jacks guest?
Keep going. You said my hatred for Alabama. That's just not true.
What I'm saying is, if you have to turn the mentality all the way around. right now it's the record, and then you look at the head-to-head, you look at the other stuff, and you look at this thing, and you look at the strength of schedule. But it really should be, at the end of the year, who the hell's the best, right? I mean, it probably could encompass injuries. I mean, what if the Irish had kicked ass on everybody, and Love and three other guys got hurt the last week?
Well, but that didn't happen. But it has happened in the past. It knocked Florida State out of the smaller field a couple of years ago because their quarterback.
What I'm saying is, let's figure out
that does count, except it.
Well, it counts sometimes.
It counts when it counts.
I'm saying when everybody at Notre Dame is pissed off that Southern Cal's offing themselves off the schedule. Okay, and I'm sitting there going, well, based on the logic this year, which I think, like you, is pretty flawed, based on the logic this year, if you're playing a conference, say the Big Ten or the SEC or somebody, and you got two studs on your schedule, and you think you might lose to them, the last thing you want is the dreaded third loss somewhere else from an out-of-conference team. I mean, if the Irish actually were in the ACC, why the hell would they grab Texas on game one? I mean, that's insane. If that loss is going to knock you out for the whole year, isn't it?
Well, I hear what you're saying, Tom. But, you know, I'll also remind you that or at least inform you that many, many, in fact, I have not seen one supportive. I've only seen them anti. SEC or USC football alumni are very, very critical of this, and they're saying that their athletic director caved in to Lincoln Riley because Lincoln Riley really didn't want to play that game at all, which is what you're saying. But on the other hand, the people involved in the rivalry don't want it killed.
But look at the rivalry.
And you know what? I'm you know, if they don't want to play, they don't want to play. Notre Dame's playing Brigham Young. Brigham Young had a better team anyway.
Well, okay.
And their quarterback's young, and he's coming back. That'll be a tougher game for him.
You can't judge. You're not doing this, but you can't judge the world by the mentality of our bozo buddies. They're living 50 years ago.
I'm judging it by the mentality of people who actually played in the rivalry.
Okay, but the rivalry now doesn't mean crap to anybody. It doesn't appear, does it? I mean, nobody cares about playing Purdue. Nobody cares about playing Michigan State. Do they? I mean, what are rivalries even? I'm with you, by the way. But
the Irish are playing Michigan State and Purdue next year.
Yeah, but I'm saying they didn't play. I'm saying, does anybody really care? Is my point. Is it? It's not like, I mean, when you got on the train and you went out there for two, and then they came your way. It was a huge deal for a school in the Midwest to be out on the West Coast for a game. I mean, now everybody's flying back and forth for volleyball games, for God's sake. I mean, I want the world you want too, Kevin. I just don't see us getting there. That's my world too, bud. I mean, I love to see that kind of rivalry. I mean, you know, but now, the rivalry with Stanford's a big rivalry. Now, well, Stanford doesn't look like they're moving up in the world, do they? Are we going to keep doing that for 50 years?
They're probably going to keep doing it for a while, but Stanford's in the ACC, so that they're...
Which is even more ridiculous, but...
Well, which is, they just call it the Coastal Conference, but...
Yeah.
that would make more sense. Let me pull up future Notre Dame schedules, because they have some good stuff coming up on their...
I look at the one next year, and it's ridiculous. They better not lose a game. Maybe one. They're good names, but they're not good teams anymore.
Well, yeah. Well, that can't be helped. I mean, that would be one thing where they should prevail on the ACC to give them better games out of the five that they're committed to playing. So
there isn't anybody, is there? They played the one good team, Miami.
Well, Miami, Clemson.
Pittsburgh was pretty good.
About names, then you're looking at that. Yeah, the Irish are playing Wisconsin, who was not good this year. They're playing in Green Bay to open the season next year. That might be fun to go to, actually.
That's it. I was going to ask you. That's what we were talking about at the wedding. I got to tell you about the wedding.
Okay, I'll let you do that. But, yeah, North Carolina, they have Miami in November. That's good. It's a good time to be playing. They have SMU, who's pretty good. Stanford, Syracuse, and then they close the season with Brigham Young. So, and you know, Brigham Young was a borderline playoff team this year. So,
Kevin, I'm with you. This year, every bitch is at the schedule. When they scheduled Boise State, those guys look like they'll be up and comers for the next three decades, and all of a sudden they went back again. You can't complain about that. When they scheduled them, they were hot. But
they were hot a year ago.
Yeah, and then people look at it and they go, oh, Asa. Wisconsin has always been a very tough game, always, for 50 years. Now all of a sudden they have not embraced this new world maybe as much as other people, and now they're a middle-of-the-road team. Well, they weren't when people talked about doing this. They were a serious team, right? So, you know, you can't really bitch at the schedule when at the time they made it, the people were pretty damn good.
Well, and actually, next year's game is a reschedule from the COVID year.
Yeah.
So, that's when they were originally supposed to play it. But, yeah, as I look at the future schedules, if you look beyond that, in 2027, they get Auburn. They get Virginia Tech, who's not bad. They play at Clemson.
Why do you suppose...
Again, they have Duke, so they can play the ACC champions.
Why do you suppose the ACC, when you had Clemson, you had Pitt was always a good team, and hell, they were national championships a few times. I mean, how all of a sudden has that conference decided to go all basketball or all baseball or something? I don't know what's going on there.
I just think they're inept. You know, that's all. 2028, they pick up Texas. They have another game against Arkansas, so Arkansas is rekindling. They get Auburn. They get Clemson. And they get Miami at a date to be determined.
I don't know that
it's a good schedule. 2029, get Alabama, Texas again. NC State's not bad. You know, as a program, it's not bad. Florida State. So, it's bulking up. Syracuse, Clemson.
Well, if you get a conference, you can't... I don't think they're necessarily inept if you don't get a bozo for every school that's willing to give them $90 bazillion like Cuban is with Indiana or the other guy is for Oregon. I mean, you can't say Duke is inept because they don't have a guy willing to piss some money all over them.
Well, it depends, because Duke, and you may remember I shared an article a long time ago, they had alumni approach the basketball program and say, whatever you need.
Okay, so...
Duke have the same kind of support for football? And I don't know the answer. Duke, really, football success in college appears to be mostly about who you have as the head coach.
And that's kind of everything.
Yes, it is true of everything, except that, you know, you... So as an example, Texas A&M's head coach, they hired him away from Duke. Duke had a pretty good team when he was there. But they didn't replace him with somebody.
Well, okay, but now what you're bringing up is a massive question here, probably the question of what we're talking about all morning. We've been talking about this forever, but is if now you don't go all in and you don't do all this stuff, are you being a retrograde or whatever you want to call it? Are you being a loser? I mean, are we forced into this absolute professional team? Because I think a lot of teams don't want to do it. And I'm not so sure how much the Irish really want to do it, to be honest with you. I mean, they're up to this level. They're with it. I don't know if it gets much more that they're going to go down that road. And maybe they are, because they got a lot of rich alumni. But, I mean, does Duke really have to come up with a $30 million payroll for their team like Oregon and pay their coach God knows what, or else they're a bunch of pansies? I don't know if I'm ready to say that.
That I don't know what to tell you, and it's going to vary from school to school as to how they do it. But I have no doubt that that a lot of these schools, you know, you can sort of look at some of them and say, you know, if they want the support, it's there for them.
Okay, if they want to sell out, there's a buyer. If they want to sell out, there's a buyer.
That's right.
Okay. Well, I mean, it is after all college football, where we used to be.
Yeah. Hey, I even see Indiana on the future schedule. So,
well, at some point here, I mean, I'm not trying to design this for anybody, but I'm just saying, here's how the way it's going. There's going to be several different ways of design. It could very well be, you know, the over $50 million payroll is in three conferences, and the under 50s and whatever. I mean, it's one thing, even though our guys refuse to believe this, and a couple of guys on the show refuse to believe it because Hal's a Cinderella guy, there's no way 5 years from now that a $40 million payroll team is going to pay a $1 million payroll team. It's unsafe. It's insane. And I don't know how you get 12 people on your schedule that are $40 million payoff teams, because first of all, you don't want to do it because you don't have the depth. You know, your people have shit beat out of them. And how, so this constant, we're going to play two games against the Bears, and we're going to play two against Slippery Rock. I mean, that to me is a non-long-term solution. But it appears that people think it is. I don't think it's going to be that way.
Well, it does appear that people think it is. You know, part of Notre Dame's issue with the schedule is that it was Brian Kelly who was advocating for making it easier. When he got there, it was a much tougher schedule at the beginning. And, you know, that goes back a long way as to them scheduling tough. But he, you know, I mean, the absurdity of Kelly leaving Notre Dame, which I'm really glad he did, is that he wanted to go someplace where he would have the ability to win a national championship. He didn't think he could do it at Notre Dame because he was always railing against whatever restrictions he had. But they gave him everything he wanted. They gave him AstroTurf. They gave him, you know, some of the stadium modifications he wanted. The big blasting video board that the kids love so much.
Well, they gave him a huge practice facility.
And they gave him the practice facility. They pretty much gave him everything he wanted, and he still didn't win. You know, he still didn't contend legitimately for the national championship. He made it to the national championship game at least once, and got stomped by Alabama. But the ultimately the point is that Freeman has come in and said, no, we are not going to live on those kind of schedules. And it just takes a few years, because all of this is future contracts. It takes a few years to beef them up. But you can see this as you start looking 2027, 2028.
Well, but you have no idea what those teams are going to look like then, just like now.
Well, yeah, except that it is hard to imagine. You know, I don't know what to expect from Clemson as an example. But when you start looking at Texas, they seem to have a pretty good foundation for being good for a long time.
They don't
time.
Look any better than Clemson did 5 years ago.
I understand that, but you know, I think they absolutely have a different commitment. Dabo Sweeney just, you know, he didn't want to get involved in transfers. He didn't want to get too involved in NIL. He's probably being dragged as now, because his job will be on the line. If, you know, he's already changing over his whole staff. So pretty soon they're going to be running out of other people to fire. They're going to have to fire him.
Well, again, it comes down to how much is the school and are the people into the new world. And I think the new world to a large extent sucks, Kevin. And,
it does. But that's not what we're discussing. We, you know, we could have a separate discussion about whether it sucks or not.
What happens?
Schedules, and you start looking at who is going to thrive in the new world. I can't imagine Texas not thriving in the new world.
When you say that, what happens to those that don't, I'll use the term, thrive? I mean, what is going to happen to, and this could, you know, they all of a sudden could get a fairy godfather tomorrow, too. What happens, I mean, we'll talk about it with our girl Larissa next week. What happens to Purdue? They don't think they ever want to be, nor should they be, or want to be, or can be, they don't want to be Ohio State paying people $50 million a year. Now, what happens to them? What happens to Ohio State, and what happens to them? They're not even anymore.
That's a good question. And yet, Purdue in basketball
Okay, so they got a good girls fencing team, too. So what? It's totally different.
Now, it is totally different, except that the same dynamic applies. You still have to be competitive for what you pay people, and they're right at the top. It's interesting that some schools have opted out of football, or not opted, they don't want to make that commitment to football, but they're totally willing to make it to basketball, because you didn't have to go back too long when people didn't want to get too involved in basketball because it was such a cesspool.
How many guys?
Let me finish the thought. They didn't want to get involved in basketball because it was too much of a cesspool, so that they were happier to be putting their eggs in the football basket.
You're talking 100 guys versus 10. It's not even close.
Well, I understand that, but basketball was always the big recruiting cesspool, and so everybody just thought it was too icky to go too deep into it, and now there's more schools willing to embrace basketball and say, you know, I'm just not willing to do it in football.
Well, how many out of the Purdue? I guess I understand they're pretty good. They always manage to get these 7-foot guys. I haven't watched them this year, but how many guys are they paying? 4, 3? 8, maybe a little bit.
They're paying them all.
Okay, but how much?
That's the question. Well, I don't know.
It's not 30 mil.
Well, I think, you know, I go back to Notre Dame. Marcus Burton's making like a mil.
Now, from who?
Out of the school funding and whatever else he does. And you know, Hannah Hidalgo is making money from the school, and she's making money on endorsements. But
she's also...
She's very marketable.
She's very marketable. That's a whole different... By the way, I would love to have him on at the same time you're on. Our buddy Scott Benjaminson, who's been on a couple times. He's I won't say retired actor, because he does some stuff even now. He's done a bunch of commercials and everything. And I wanted him to bring us up to speed on when you had to be in the... when you got to join the union and all those other kinds of things. Because Audrey, maybe she can talk about it next time she's on, because when Audrey was doing Drum Corps, they did some commercials, and they got to be on like once or twice, and after that you had to join the union. At that time, the union was $500, and they weren't even getting paid for the thing. I mean, the club was, and they didn't do it, but they were only a couple of times. But, you know, everybody said, oh man, we don't hate unions. Well, the union is the one who polices your residuals, so you don't have to do it. So if you're in the union and you get residuals for a commercial, they keep track of when the commercial runs. So they actually provide quite a service to everybody. But they can come through. I mean, when you have there's got to be a big difference between who's the four kind of stars, where they just one guy's swinging the bat and the other girl's whipping the basketball in or something, and they don't do anything. They don't talk. I think that's a different level than if you talk. There's a different level if they show your face. But I think pretty quickly you have to pony up for the union. Now, Hannah Hidalgo was on, and there's a big difference between Caitlin Clark being on a State Farm commercial and actually talking than somebody just being seen in a picture with a Red Bull to your face. A huge difference. I don't know what the difference is.
Hidalgo's done State Farm, too.
That's right. But now she was she one of the group that didn't talk? That's what I want to ask Scott about.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's... I suspect you can only do a few of those before joining the union, but I think there's a difference in how much you get paid. I know if you're an extra in a movie, you can get paid like $5, but if you say something, it's way more. Anyway, your name was bandied about at the wedding Tuesday night or Wednesday night.
Were there adjectives in front of it?
No, they were just asking me who's on the show. I said Kevin's on the show, and they're asking about you and blah blah blah. How everybody is pretty good representation of our group. And wedding was quite the spectacular event.
So who got married?
Our buddy Jim Doherty's son.
Oh, okay.
And let's just say it might have been the political event of the new year. Everybody who was a who's who in the city was there, pretty much.
That's interesting.
Was it the Holy Family Church? I'd never been in there before. God, is that place gorgeous. Holy Family, for those that don't know, is the one church that, maybe the one or two churches that survived the Chicago Fire of 1871. And they're down the block from the old St. Ignatius School. It now has got money on top of money, and now it's huge. And they bought all the land around it and all those athletic facilities and stuff. And I'd have not been in there, Kevin, since I toured the place in 1966 when I got out of grammar school. I mean, maybe wanted to go to high school there, but it was so far from where I lived, and the bus that puttered down Western Avenue looked like it was not going to last. And it was, you know, I just didn't want to do it. If you played any kind of sport, God knows when you got home, that kind of thing. But now, you know, it's really, it's the spot. I mean, it's Jesuit. All the kids there go from, like, Boston College or someplace afterward, and the place is gorgeous. And they have this huge reception hall, and I look up at the window, and I see whose name is on the reception call, and I'm looking over, and he's sitting at the table right next to me. I'm like, okay, then. I don't know how much. So I said, hey, this thing must have set you back a little bit. Oh, yeah, way too much. I'm like, okay, then. But now, does it matter more if you're married by a bishop?
Does it matter more? Yeah, I think it's holier.
Is it going to last? Anyway, Jim has a terrific...
Is it going to last any longer? Good question.
Jim has a terrific family. He's the nicest guy. And the one part that was pretty tough to not have a tear come out, Kevin, was the other side of the family is the Wendt family, George Wendt family. And George was popular to everybody. I mean, when he was home, he wasn't a movie star. It wasn't like in New York where they're taking pictures of him. He was home because I went out with him a couple times, and we just went to a bar on Western Avenue, and, hey, George, how are you? How's acting? Fine. That was it. I mean, he could hang with his buddies. Chicago's not like New York in that regard. And George was, when he came home, Beverly, he was just George. And, so the young kid who's getting married, also his name is George, but George Doherty, he said, I called up Uncle George, and I said, what do you think? I'm thinking, it's an interesting story, Kevin, because the kid went to St. Ignatius, and because the name, Doherty, I don't know what the lady's name was, I should know, I went to their wedding, was right next to him. So they sat next to each other in the homeroom, and their lockers were next to each other. So that's how they met. They had all kind of the same friends long before they became boyfriend girlfriend.
It's their school lockers, not their gym lockers, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, the school lockers. And then they became whatever. So I called up Uncle George, and I go, George, what do you think? I'm thinking of getting married. And he goes, well, do you like her enough? And he goes, well, yeah, I do. And he goes, well, then George's response was, well, then marry the hell out of her. whatever that means. And then they played the theme from Cheers, and there wasn't a dry eye in the place. I mean, there couldn't have been a more popular guy ever on the South Side as George Went. I mean, because he was nice to everybody. And he's, of course, he had 10 brothers and sisters that are nice, too. So it's kind of a Chicago thing. And, you know, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. But we bleeped out at 12. It was going to go to 1:30. I mean, it was they had a 10-piece band. Good Lord. And, you know, of course, Audrey would have been dancing the last dance if I didn't drag her out of there. I mean, Audrey will go all night. Not me. But it was fun. A lot of our buddies are Craig Whitey, Artie Moore, all asking about you. So it's fun to see everybody. And but to say there were enough gray-haired old Irish guys in the place was an understatement. Anybody? So, hey, what do you make of this year, bud? We've got markets up today. Gold and silver seem to be rocketing all over the place. We got China is restricting silver exports now. Whatever we seem like we do to those guys to cut some kind of a deal, they kind of stick another burr under us the next week. I didn't realize silver was used so much in a lot of this stuff for these other kind of metals, these rare earth stuff. Is silver used to process some of it? I mean, I thought once you stopped doing regular pictures where you needed silver nitrate to do the film, that the industrial use of silver would kind of drop, but evidently not. So I'm going to... Maybe we'll get Carl to talk about that when he comes on. But
our next young man, who actually is online now. So the younger guy who's coming on.
But I mean,
the younger guy.
Kid, yes. Yeah,
what is, out of all the stuff, Carl, that might have been the metals, and we have people in gold, we have people in silver, we have a few people in copper. Most people in copper are in Freeport, McMoRan, because there's not really a good copper ETF, but... You know, it's done okay. I would never really have guessed. We don't have anybody in platinum. Once in a while, people call and ask about it, and then I don't think we've ever had anybody in platinum. We used to do a real lot of futures stuff. We had a couple of people. Those contracts are so damn big. But I would never have guessed silver would be the one that would become this crazy trader here, and yet, obviously, wrong again. We got a lot of people in silver, so it's been really good for us, but I would never... You'd ask me early in the year if silver was going to close at $65, the SLV... And I said, you're out of your mind. And yet, we got people in there, and they made the dough. So it's good for us and good for them.
Well, I mean, it's... So silver is much more of an industrial metal than gold is. Gold is an industrial metal. However, you know, people are, oh, it's money. No, it hasn't been money. It was historically money. The reason it was used as money is because it's self-verifying. And self-verification is an extremely important component of a currency. You can pick up a $20 bill and look at it and feel it and be reasonably sure it's real. It's not counterfeit. Okay. Now you may be wrong, by the way. I mean, you know, counterfeiters have gotten much more sophisticated over the years. But in general, I mean, if you're somebody that handles cash, my daughter used to work in retail. And every now and then she'd have somebody come in there and try to pass a bad 5 or a bad 20, right? And
well, you're pretty low down the chain if you're passing a bad 5.
Believe it or not, Chief, it's actually in regular, ordinary retail, 5 draws less scrutiny, so it's actually relatively common, which surprised me. I didn't know this.
So what do you get, 2 candy bars for a 5 these days?
I mean, my take on it is that, you know, 5 is basically a worthless denomination to counterfeit, right? Because, I mean...
That's what I would think.
Because counterfeits are not cheap to make, okay? They're not free. You know, you got to spend some money to make them. And, you know, that the return on investment is low enough that it's not worth it. But, you know, 20s are. And, as it turns out, she actually caught more bad 5s than 20s, which I don't know, fascinated me. Anyway... If you handle the, you know, currency on a regular basis, you don't need those fancy pens and all that crap. Okay, you really don't need them. It goes through your fingers. You're like,
I would say the paper. The paper is more telling than the print.
The thing that I always think is interesting is my daughter, like I said, she used to work in that, in retail where she handled currency on a regular basis from customers. And if you do it all the time, because that's your job, you don't need anything fancy. You know instantly. As soon as somebody hands it to you, you know it's bogus. You don't have to look at it closely. And of the ones that she interdicted, she was only wrong once.
Really?
And, well, and she probably bounced 30 or 40 of them over the space of a few years.
Well, one of our guy, he's been on the show a couple times. He had a marijuana place that he's since sold. But when they first were putting it together and it was going to open, they went to Riot Fest and they had a booth where they sold T-shirts.
Yeah.
And sure enough, at the end of the night, they ended up with a couple of clunker hundreds.
Yeah.
I pull one out of my, I have one in my pocket, I pull them out together, and you if you really looked at them, you could tell under the light and you could sort of feel a difference, but yeah. No way in a dark park at 8 o'clock at night you were going to tell a difference.
Well, actually, again, it comes down to, do you do this all the time? Okay. Because it is not something that, I mean, yes, there's objective things, if you're in retail, they got like a little thing that the BEP passes around and publishes that's, how to tell the difference between a real, real bill and a fake bill, right? But if you actually work in retail and you handle currency on a regular basis, you don't need that.
It says here, this is the article. Earlier this month, China released a list of 44 companies approved to export silver. 44 right. is a lot. Under the new measures in 2026 and 2027, the new rules in 2026 also restrict exports of tungsten and antimony. I know what tungsten is. What the hell is antimony? Materials dominated by China's supply chain and widely used in defense and advanced technologies. All right, then it goes on to say...
Antimony is and tungsten are both fairly heavily used in electronics and defense in particular, for tungsten. But antimony is a doping agent that is used in semiconductor manufacturing. So, I mean, these are, all of these, and that's the thing that silver is kind of goes there too, is that the antimony is also a component in solder. So as is silver, by the way.
Well, it says it's citing its use in electrical circuits, batteries, solar cells, and antibacterial medical instruments. What's that all about?
So metals, all metals, to some extent, are metabolic poisons. All of them.
By the way, they exported 4,600 tons in the first 11 months of the year.
Well, antimony is
not... No, this is silver. It's silver.
Yeah, well, silver, sure. But antimony is also it's a flame retardant. Not by itself as a metal, but as an oxide. So there's a specific oxide that's used as a flame retardant, and it has a low melting point, which is one of the reasons that it's very useful in that regard. But yeah, it's in infrared detectors, batteries, battery technology, semiconductors, and things like this.
Well, one of the reasons why it sort of surprises me is there's a gentleman I talk to once in a while in the local emporium, and he owns a bunch of these what do they call metal rehab facilities.
Yeah.
I've talked to him about some of the... Well, he ended up... He had a big break-in and a robbery at one of his places.
Right.
And he tells me that they have... He's got, thousands and thousands of pounds of copper.
Right.
And most of it in wire and other... in every part of a washing machine's got copper wire in it, you name it. He says he has a surprising amount of gold that every computer you have, a desktop has... I won't say an ounce, but he goes, it might be a... It's a very small piece of gold, but you can sort of separate that, and you get all this real,
absolutely
dirty gold, and you can send it to some people that actually can separate it. I mean, it's a big process, but you never once mentioned silver that in anything that goes into anything that's recycled. Was that just in batteries or what? Because he says, I didn't ask him, but he was talking all about copper and talking about gold, but he didn't say anything about silver.
Yeah, there's, well, silver is a little bit harder. It's a harder to recycle because it forms compounds more easily. Gold basically doesn't.
Gold just stays gold, right? That's why you buy it.
Yeah, gold. Well, that's one of the reasons it was used as a monetary metal is that it's easy to self verify. Put a little drop of acid on it, and if it, you know, gold will just sit there and look at it. You know, whereas virtually everything else will be oxidized by it and bubble, right? And so you could actually, you know, it's one of the tests historically for, you know, okay, is this guy?
That's why you use it in your teeth.
Well, same reason. Yeah, exactly. Well, and the other thing is it has a reasonably compatible coefficient of expansion with tissue, which is, I mean, if you're making fillings or crowns or something, that's really important because, you know, as temperatures change, you don't want to disbond the, you know, the crown from the tooth, right? That would be bad. So now, as it turns out, modern ceramics are actually better matched in that regard. It's one of the reasons that they've taken over. Everyone's like, it's because gold's so expensive. No, actually, it's not. It's because the coefficient of expansion, while it's close, is not an exact match, and you can get very, very close to an exact match with modern composites. Silver, though, is the primary component in non lead bearing solder, which there's a regulation called ROHS, R-O-H-S, that essentially was put into place because the disposal of old electronics back when lead was used as a primary solder component, and the primary solder component, of course, poses a problem in that you throw that in the trash and it goes in a landfill, and lead over time leaches into the groundwater. This is not good.
Well, for those that have never delved into this stuff, and I was never any kind of an engineer, Carl, I'm just lobbing this one out there. If you worked at a place like Pullman, they didn't do that much soldering. There's like hundreds of kinds of welding flux. There's hundreds of kinds of solder. I mean, there's a solder for every purpose and a purpose for. I mean, it's incredible what you use for all these different things and the chemistry behind it and the engineering behind it. And if you've never seen that happen, you have no idea. You think, hey, it's solder. What's the difference? Or what's a welding plug?
And actually, the chemistry behind it is rather fascinating, especially with solder in particular, which I'm very familiar with. They've mostly solved this problem, but over when lead-free solder first showed up, one of the reasons people didn't want to use it originally is not just cost. Of course, silver only bearing solder is more expensive for obvious reasons. It's, you know, silver, even before it went crazy, it was much more expensive than lead. However, it has a really nasty property over time in that it tends to grow whiskers. So do old guys, yeah. Well, the problem with this is they're technically called dendrites, but it grows whiskers over time, and so as a result, there's a risk of shorts because the solder that you soldered the component on with can grow a whisker to the adjacent pin and short out the device. Okay, now, for obvious reasons, that's bad.
Yeah.
Okay, but this was one of the challenges with coming up with lead-free formulations is how do we stop that from happening? And so, I mean, they have to a large degree, it's considered a controlled problem now, but, 20, 30 years ago, this was actually when they first started, with this ROHS regulatory stuff. There were a lot of people that said this is a problem we haven't fixed on an engineering level, and this is going to have a serious impact on service life of electronics.
Kevin, is your all the stuff you guys teach at your school if you wanted to go to learn about welding engineering or SETA, where would you get? Who teaches that? Anybody?
Oh yeah, we have some full time people who do some teaching in welding. And related stuff, but we get a lot of people out of industry that come and teach at night.
Really, because one of Pullman's first cachets was they were the first company in the country, maybe the world, to learn how to weld aluminum.
Oh, there you go.
And in fact, they had pictures when I was there. Somebody wanted to put up a bridge somewhere, a highway bridge, was made of aluminum, and they did all the sections got welded in the Pullman factory, and they took them out there and somehow bolted them together because they didn't trust their people to weld them out on when they were
out in the field.
Out in the field. And it's a real big deal, I guess, to weld aluminum.
It has to be done under inert gas, so you can't stick weld it. It has to be done under inert gas, and the reason is that aluminum, one of the reasons people like it as a structural metal is that it self-protects, doesn't corrode. It forms a thin layer of oxide on the surface, and that prevents further oxidation. Okay, so unlike iron, which rusts, and the rust is not protective, except for quart and steel, which is specially formulated in such a way that it sort
but
of
aluminum,
does.
Aluminum can pit. You got to constantly look on airplanes for if it's pitting. What's the difference between pitting and corroding?
Well, the difference is that if there is a way for that oxide layer to be breached, then the metal underneath it can corrode again to form another one.
Okay, so they
okay. So it's so under certain environmental conditions, it will be destroyed by corrosion just like iron is. But in general, one of the things, like if you have aluminum siding, it's usually painted. There was a whole load of it that was improperly primed at the factory. the actual sheets that it's made of were improperly primed at the factory. That was just before the great financial crisis in the 2006-2007 time frame, and an awful lot of people have flashing and stuff that was made from that stuff. And over the period of many years, what ends up happening is that the paint that's on the top, because the primer is incorrectly bonded, comes off. So now it's ugly, but on the side of your house, it actually will not corrode. It's just that now you've got a white piece of trim that is half metal because the paint is coming off.
Well, hey, Carl, we still have Kevin for a few minutes. SPV are the same spot. They're up 38, and NASDAQ is up 242. Yeah. We've talked an awful lot about the veteran stuff for a while in the last few weeks, and I've tried to maintain a little bit of a theme regarding the divergent views of the world. Larissa talked very eloquently, I thought, on Wednesday regarding the K-shaped recovery and how some people are doing way better than others, and at some level, money for nothing and your chicks for free, and the other level people are cutting coupons and depending on how you look, and if you look at how people especially a lot of the medical care stuff, if you're abused by that, by somebody being sick or not being covered, it can make a life-changing experience in a second, and nobody's been more eloquent on that than our friend Carl. I've kind of run all this by Kevin, and you look at in the sports world, some places people are throwing millions of dollars thinking that 10 years from now, the price of a Notre Dame or Bulls or a Bears ticket's going to be $1,000 and the world's going to be their oyster, and other people are thinking, who the hell's going to afford it? And I'm not so sure. I don't know where this is going to land. I know that the last time we were this disparate was broken in half in terms of the economy, we had 1929, and I sure as hell want to see that. So I guess, Kevin, I'll ask you first, since you might be having a head, but who's going to win out? I mean, the that's why even your numbers, if you look in a mathematical tone, I'd say I've never seen a bigger difference between the mean and the median, if that's a fair way to say it. What do you think about all this? I mean, where are we going to land? I mean, you got your school trying to do stuff to make it worthwhile for people, every man to go there, and the other places don't seem to care if they charge $20,000 for room and board. I mean, where do you see this all coming together, or does it have to?
Well, it's just something I was going to mention earlier. We are going to see, for better or for worse, and I think there's a lot of worse in there, but we, over the next year, we're going to see a lot of changes. I think I had mentioned this before, that that the policies, Trump's policies, are going to a lot depends on whether the tariffs survive, and we'll see about that. But I guess what I'm getting at is we are reshaping the economy. We are reshaping world trade, and it's going to be different.
And a lot of this stuff is kicking in. It's kicking in with the bill they passed last year, and so I think we're gonna see. Is that going to be good for people or bad for people? Who's it going to help? I mean, everything we do is going to help the upper level, the top 10% of the economy. That's just always true. But the question is it going to do anything for anybody else? And I don't know the answer. If we see a lot more employment in manufacturing and those kinds of businesses, then I think it will help, and we'll see more benefit across the economy. But I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what the impact is going to be 100%. But we're going to see, and so there's a part of me that just says, okay, make some popcorn, sit back and watch it.
Well, I mean, people wonder what the everyday decisions are. I mean, we're not none of the three of us, maybe Carl, is in position to buy a football team, right? And when you look at what somebody, let's pay $8 billion for the Bears, and I'm sure the books are probably cooked or something, but they're making allegedly $200 million, which is a lot of dough. Well, let's say it's $250 million because they got everybody on salary. All right, so by my calculation, I go, okay, that's a crap deal. If my interest rate is 7%, that's $560 million a year in interest, and I'm making $200 million. That looks like about a bankruptcy halfway through the first year. Yet, people are doing it. Now, the people who are doing it are not idiots. They're not coming to me and say, "Hey, Chief, your calculation somehow, some way, they are thinking this is a good deal," because their view of something, I think, is different than maybe ours. Now, but one thing you learn about trading is every time you make a trade, this is really hard to explain to people. When you go buy a stock, I like this NVIDIA, I'm going to pay $189.20 for it, which is trading right now. Somebody's selling it to me. There is a chance that guy could be smarter than me this minute, this month, this year, this forever. Now, maybe not, because stuff keeps wanting to go up. But, I mean, I don't think that the McCaskey or somebody's going to buy the Bears can't make the calculation I just made. So obviously they have a different view of things. And what Larissa was talking about on Wednesday is, can two sections of the economy race off in two different directions forever? And the other side, the argument there is it sure didn't happen in 29. But the other argument is the world, really, except for the U.S. for the last, for a 50-year slam, has been like that all the time. Some people have all the dough, and some people don't. Now, are we going to stay the America that we used to know, or are we going to change? And yeah, some people just have all the dough, and other people aren't. Right? And by the way, there's always going to be 60,000 people or 65 that will spend $1,000 for a Bear ticket in the year 2031. I mean, it's an interesting view of things. I don't know how you even teach that in school, Kevin, if you're going to look at pricing and capital acquisitions, but it clearly comes into play. I mean, if we're going to have a 10%, if Trump's going to throw some lackey in the Federal Reserve spot, and we have a 10% money supply growth every year, those tickets could be 2,000, not 1,000. I mean, how do you view
yeah,
this?
I don't know the answer to that, Tom. I would just be, speculating. Almost mindlessly. The real question is, can you have a K-shaped economic growth and yet the middle part of the K has a better bulge in it than it used to? And boy, that doesn't, I have to reword that one as soon as those words came out of my mouth. But can it have less of a disparity in the process than it has historically, or than it has recently?
Well, I'll search the office and find there's a piece of paper here where a group of people did a study, and from 1948 I think to 1982-ish, somewhere in there, they cut the economy up into five different groups: lower 20%, next one, da da da, and over that period of time, everybody was almost exactly equal and how much they progressed in terms of wealth. At the bottom 20%, you know, where it was getting better by 3% a year, and actually the second one from the bottom, the 20 to 40, did a little better than everybody for some reason. He was pretty surprised at that, but a little bit, just a little bit. Then they did it from like 1980-something till today, and it's dramatically different. It's the top 20% not only did more than all the rest, the top 10% of the 20% did more than all the rest of the 20%. I mean, it's you wouldn't think it was the same country. And now the question is that sustainable? I mean, I would think maybe no, but it was for centuries, Carl, unfortunately.
Well, it was for centuries, and you had, you know, pretty close to literal slavery for an awful lot of time too, right? So I mean, the thing is that it wasn't illegal to own people back then. It is now, at least in theory, right? I mean, we may honor this in the modern world. We may honor it more in the breach than the observance through various gameplay, you know, game playing elements that we engage in. But the reality of it is that, you know, you take a look at what's probably going on here. You know, this whole Somali thing that's blown up in the news, right? And what I always find fascinating about this is that whenever a scandal like this starts, it's always, you know, one set of guys are, you know, they're evil as Satan, and everybody else is as pure as an angel from heaven.
Oh yeah,
right. That's always how this starts. And the more you dig into it, and the more data you look at, the more you conclude that what you really got is very similar to what we have within the medical system as a whole, which is that every single person in there is in some way, directly or indirectly, on the take. Okay? Now, whether they have actually themselves personally crossed a legal line that would allow you to jail them is a different question. Even given the existing authorities or whatever authority you might want to, you know, to generate over time. That's not the question. The question is whether or not their earnings in that field are through their own industry, art, and, you know, provision of a good or service on voluntary terms to other people. And that is, it is never the case that any industry is free from all areas of corruption. That's just never true. Right? It's never been true in human history, and it never will be. But the salient point is how contaminated is this, and is that actually the root of the strategy? And I think if you look back at history throughout time, not just now in the United States over the last, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, whatever, you know, my time as an adult, but pull the lens back further, the reason that 15 U.S.C. Chapter 1 was passed originally at the end of the 1800s was because Standard Oil did the same effing thing.
Yeah.
Okay? And the people got pissed off about it. Congress passed a law. And then it's as if the what's old isn't new again. Why was Clayton passed? Clayton was passed, you know, 15, 20 years later, because they tried to bring charges under the original Sherman Act, and the people that they charged were able to successfully defend against the charge and not go to jail because they said, well, we tried to monopolize and failed. And Sherman said, all those who create or maintain a monopoly, okay, or impact, you know, damage competition this way. So Congress begs, wait a minute, you guys didn't go to jail because you said, well, yeah, we tried to do that, but this jackass.
Well, it also was a very general, in some ways it's way more powerful of a bill, some ways it's not, because some of the stuff in the Clayton actually lists specific things that are wrong no matter what.
You know, well, Clayton turned around and said, okay, attempting it is the same offense as getting away with it. Okay.
Well, it was when I was in school and they talked about this, it had to do with more. One was very specific and one...
Clayton also included some additional, very specific, you know, tripwires, right?
That you can't do even if you're not a monopoly.
Correct.
Yeah.
But Clayton, the essence of Clayton and the reason it was passed is because there were successfully defended cases under Sherman that said we attempted to monopolize and restrain trade, but some other jackass in the field undercut us, and therefore legally we did not actually meet the definition of the Sherman Act. Okay.
Yeah, we just sucked at being monopolists.
We tried to be monopolists, but we sucked. Yeah.
Just as a little example here, the Clayton Act went on to outlaw like price discrimination against competing in account. Now Sherman was quiet on all this. Robinson Patman was after it, but conditioning sales on exclusive dealing, mergers and acquisitions when they substantially reduce competition. But here's one that nobody talks about: serving on the board of directors of two competing companies. People do that all the time now, don't they?
Oh yeah, and that's explicitly illegal.
Yeah, and people do it all the time.
And the thing is that there's and then you have. The classic argument is that, is vertical integration, is that an antitrust problem as opposed to horizontal? And classical antitrust theory says that vertical integration isn't necessarily a problem, but horizontal integration is per se a violation. So,
explain to everybody what the difference is.
The difference is that if let's say that I make copper wire, buying up copper mines in order to get the copper and then buying the smelter to refine the copper that comes out of the ground, that's vertical integration. I'm essentially...
If you have 25 clients and you all sell the copper to at the same price, and all of a sudden you zero in to where you give your one guy a little bit better deal, then that's a problem.
Right, but horizontal integration is the spreading out of that entire thing across the competitive landscape.
If there's 50 hamburger joints in town and one of them buys another, it's probably no big deal. But if there's two in town and one buys another, now you got a problem.
Now that's trouble, right?
Yeah.
Because now you've essentially monopolized all of the hamburger joints.
But that's not exactly vertical integration. Vertical integration is I'm buying the beef processor.
Right.
I can take it to the farm.
If you buy all the hamburger joints, it's horizontal integration.
Right.
Because now you're the only guy that you can get hamburgers from. So.
Yeah. So there's a couple of different flavors of this.
I don't think we even know how to.
And where vertical is vertical markets is sort of tangentially related to what we do or not. You could be Berkshire Hathaway and. That's just a conglomerate. But a good example of a vertical markets attempt that was an abject failure was Hooters Air. They thought that if they took their business model to an airline and just put attractive young women as flight attendants wearing shorts and t-shirts, that would be a big success. And so it was a vertical markets attempt. The problem was, of course, that they sucked at running an airline.
Everybody
seems to suck at running an airline.
Yeah, but other airlines are pretty good at if when you do cost accounting and you do, there's something called a wheel of retailing, which I won't go into, but it says when people get kind of fat and heavy, somebody's always going to come in and undercut them on price.
Yeah.
But we've seen in our lifetimes probably... not 20, but 10 to 12 to 15 instances where our current airlines, as Carl would say, should all have gone to jail. Because when you have, if the three of us decided, hey, look, it really only costs X amount of bucks to fly from here to Denver, all right? And we're going to go out, and you can buy used planes pretty much anywhere you want. They're not maybe as fuel efficient, but they're pretty cheap. We could go buy four or five of these things for not a whole lot of dough. If we could get a gate that aren't all spoken for, even though they may not be being used, the airlines control them even though they don't use them. If we can get a gate, if we can get a landing slot, which they again control even if they don't lose them. So right now I'm into like three pages of the Clayton Act we're all guilty of. And when all of a sudden we start flying from Midway to Denver for $200 a pop, there's nothing that says, well, actually there is something that says, United Airlines all of a sudden now on the same Chicago to Denver pop, lowering theirs from 300 to 150 to screw us. And when it totally is an outlier to the rest of their pricing thing, they can now compete against us. Even in the minute we're out of business, they drop it, raise it back up to 300. Broken three laws in there, and they've done it for 40 years I've been watching the industry.
Well, Chief, okay, the same thing is how Amazon put together AWS and exploited that.
Yeah.
Okay, because and cross-subsidization of that sort is supposed to be a per se violation of antitrust law. All right, now it's even more the case when you've got a regulated component in there somewhere. So, and this was one of the things that we dealt with at MCS quite heavily, because Ameritech was into this sort of thing, as were the other long-haul telco carriers. So they had tariffed rates on certain things. So, you know, you're familiar with this because you were in the railroad industry.
Oh, yeah.
All right. All right. If you've got a filed tariff that says that, you know, for a ton of freight from this place to this place.
All right, explain a tariff has two definitions here. Tariff is not
right.
This tariff is not what Trump's doing. This is a
this is not a tax.
Yeah.
Right. This is a published rate sheet, essentially, that says that for this particular service, this is how much everyone pays. And so you have your power utility has a filed tariff for residential power delivery. All right, doesn't matter if you're Joe or Jack, if the price is 15 cents a kilowatt hour and a $25 meter charge every month, it's 15 cents a kilowatt hour and $25 meter
charge
for everybody.
The same, like you've been saying, is hauling a boxcar from, you know, Atlanta to Chicago.
Yeah, if my price to haul a boxcar is $5 a mile, it's $5 a mile for everybody.
Except okay. Theirs went so deep as what was in the boxcar determined how much it cost.
Yeah, so I mean it can get complicated,
yeah.
Right? But the thing is that, you know, this is kind of how in the service world you extended Robinson Patman in the services, essentially. Okay, in certain areas where otherwise there was a monopolist presence. So, you know, there's only so many railroad tracks, right, that go from one place to another.
Well, before you had roads, that's why it was a total monopoly.
Well, yeah, and so, yeah. I mean, but this was the thing. So, anyway, in telecommunications, now, this is much less true today because now there's very little in the way of monopoly left in terms of, other than the last mile right-of-way access into your house or your business. But that did not, of course, used to be the case. Okay, the only people that had those rights of way access were the Bells, and then some of the competitive local exchange providers. Well, the Bells all had published tariffs. So if you wanted to buy a DS1, which was a T1 circuit, or DS3, which was 44.7 megabits of base capacity in each direction, or an OC3, which is an optical circuit, 155. Those had tariffed costs. So if I wanted to buy one of those, I'm supposed to pay the same price as everybody else that wants to buy one. All right?
And they jam it through the state legislature. Has no idea what they're voting on. All of a sudden, you got something staring you in the face, and you go, wait a minute, what is this?
This was one of the things that the DSL guys tried to exploit, because there was a tariff for bare copper loops. No signal on it, just a pair of copper wire, okay? And the DSL people tried to ram this. And by the way, the reason these were on the tariff schedule originally was because they were used for alarm circuits. Okay, so if you had a supervised alarm, didn't make a phone call, it was actually a hardwired piece of copper wire back to the central office, which any high security business did, because if you tamper with it, it goes off. Okay, so think about it as a light switch that, you know, that goes all the way back to the central office. Anybody screws with it, tries to cut the circuit to prevent the alarm from going off, it goes off anyway. So the DSL guys tried to play hell with the exchange carriers with these tariffs. But anyway, what these guys were doing was they were finding ways to cheat. The local exchange guys were finding ways to cheat the tariff rules and essentially bundle that, which was a regulated service, with something else that wasn't, and screw people who didn't use their particular, whatever the other thing was. All right, we fought these battles constantly.
Well, in the old days, they would always say it was a box of books, or it was a box of electronics, or a box of gold.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, one of the older scams out there is that media mail has the cheapest, it's the lowest priority mail transmission, but it's also a lot cheaper. And you can still send things media mail. It still exists.
Okay, well, Carol, you know what? Let's turn a page here.
Yeah.
And let's say what we're determining here are really governmental policies. I mean, they have to do with, when I say that, matter of fact, at this really nice wedding I was at the other night, the conversation at our table at one point, even though we had the speaker for the band right next to our ear, but the couple times they went on break, the question to me was, you know, what do you think the market's going to do? And I said, well,
yeah,
I've never seen anything quite like this, because we have companies that are amazingly overvalued by any sort of metric, historical metric, but you have...
Well, the entire market's overvalued.
Yeah, but then again, you have money being poured in that appears to going to be pumped things up even higher, because the dollar, the value of the dollar is going to continue to go down, not just against other currencies, but against stuff. And you have this, you know, I said you can look at a thing like NVIDIA or Meta, and you'd say, boy, oh boy, they're not only overvalued, they're so big, how the hell are they going to grow anything from here? But in the same token, both of them have bought another place in the last 2 weeks.
Well, so, not only that.
Yeah, so I mean, these are just three variables that you're dealing with. I mean, if you look at any one of them, you say, well, okay, that merger is not going to go through because look how big they are already, and the other person was a competitor, but it goes through under goes through under any administration, really, and the odds are the current one is even more happy with it, but they may not be, but it looks like they are. I mean, it doesn't look like anything that we talk about in terms of monopolization of places, stuff that's going to deal with something less in the medical area and those kinds of things. None of that appears to be on the front burner of this administration after 1 year. Right now there's no way, if you're sitting at this table with us at the wedding, somebody's going to say, wait a minute, If this is a merger that doesn't look too good, it's going to be the last one because Trump has said this ain't happening again. He hasn't said that. So
no, let me tie this back to where I was going with this before we ended up in 17.
Well, I'm trying to get to the point where does that mean this overvalued company could actually be a buy? And that's why I'm looking at silver right now. If you would have told me at the beginning of the year for my clients that are in there going, this thing's going to trade 67 and it's trading 30, I go, we're going to be out long before then. And now where I'm sitting there going, these guys keep pumping currency in, I'm not so sure we want to get out.
Right. Well, let me here's the basic problem that all of these people have figured out how to do and have done it. Okay? Which I mean, and healthcare is the poster child for it, but by no stretch of the imagination the only example. You know, this NVIDIA thing is even more amusing, because over this last couple of days there's a rumor floating around that they intend to double the price of their higher-end GPUs. Okay, now, Chief, think about what would normally happen to you if you did that in a commodity market. Okay.
You wouldn't sell one.
Well, you'd never get away with it. Right?
Yeah, or you wouldn't sell one. You're anywhere near competitive. Yeah. You double your price. You double the price of soybeans at your farmer. Guess what? Nobody comes and picks them up.
And they all rot on the ground, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's... But the thing is that, you know, this announcement comes out. Now, that's not... If that kind of thing isn't evidence of an unlawful monopoly, I don't know what the hell is, all right? But here we are with that. And all these guys, where they've gone, and the medical system is the poster child.
Well, okay, back up here, though. If you do it, it's not totally anti-competitive, but if they can do it for 3 or 4 years before everybody catches up and kicks them in the ass, that 3 or 4 years is pretty good.
Well, but again, nobody in their right mind would try this unless they were pretty sure they had a monopoly.
This guy, I think he's Harold Janine on steroids. This guy runs his company. That's just me.
Well, what's going on here in this environment is that the goal is you get large enough, okay, that if you get stepped on by the government for violating these laws, which have been on the books for
years. Wasn't there a book written like this called Too Big to Fail?
Well, So if you get this large, what happens if they step on it is an instant recession, right?
Yeah.
Formally.
Or even if it isn't, any dumb politician would be talked into thinking that it is. We can't let J.P. Morgan go under, the world will fall apart. No, it won't.
Well, no, it won't. And as I pointed out back in 08 when this was going on before, I said, look, banking is a required service because I have to have somewhere to deposit my paycheck, okay? And, oh, by the way, the car dealer down the street has to have some way to balance his payments for the vehicles versus the ones he sells. The cash has to go somewhere. The guy who borrowed the money, somehow that system has to exist because these reserves have to be balanced between institutions, okay? So if this bank goes out of business, now there's an empty building sitting there. I could buy it at 10 cents on the dollar. Tomorrow there'll be another bank.
Right,
and it'll,
right.
It'll have a different name on the door, but there will be a bank there.
Carl and Kevin Bank.
Yeah, I mean, there will be a bank there.
Hey, Kevin's got a lot of banking experience. He might be the guy you want.
Well, yeah, I'm just saying.
I'm done with that industry. Thank you.
What do you mean? What if you were an owner? You'd be back in a flash.
Well, there you go. But the thing is that this is not, you know, as a function in the economy, it's not going away. Right? The individual institution may go away, but the function is not going to go away. No matter what happens, somebody is going to step up and say, hey, there's a competitive hole here. I'm going to go fill it. And so, because there is a fair profit to be made doing it. The problem now is that, you know, if you take, you know, medical systems 20% of GDP, before this...
Oh, no, it's 6.5%. Look at your CPA.
Sure it is. Okay, yeah. 20% of GDP. If you put it back to the 4 that it was before this insanity took hold, if you enforce the law, that would collapse prices by 75 to 80%, all right? Because, I mean, that's just what would happen. Well, guess what? That GDP would disappear temporarily. Now it would get reallocated into other parts of the economy. But at the moment you did it, you'd have a depression.
It would not take long.
No, it would not. But Chief, during that, look, in 1920-21, okay, when speculative mania blew up there, all right, and Hoover counseled for immediate intervention, Treasury Secretary. Immediate intervention, didn't get it, all right? There was the sharpest decline in GDP ever recorded in American history. And within 18 months, not only was the economy back to full employment, the largest posted growth rates in GDP were also posted up, okay? Because all that stuff that got puked up at crazy discounts made for ridiculous opportunities
for everybody else. What year are you talking?
2021.
Right.
The depression that nobody recognized as a depression because it was over too fast.
Well, yeah, we also had that was sort of different because you just shut places down and just opened back up.
Well, no, you shut places down. The guys that owned them went bankrupt. Somebody else came
in.
Well,
but other places ended up having a huge year because you gave them money.
Actually, no. That was the whole thing. Was they didn't give them money. They didn't drop rates. They didn't do what we do now. They let it blow up.
Well, I'm talking about general industries. Like there were some people that were paid to stay in business that did pretty damn good.
2021 was essentially a leave it alone and let it burn economic correction.
I'm talking about more a COVID thing because it led right into that.
Oh, no, I'm not talking to, no, that's 2020. I'm talking 1920.
Oh, you said 2020.
No, 1920, right. 21.
Yeah, okay.
But now we're on a two-year election cycle and nobody wants to take the medicine because the medicine will hurt them in the election cycle.
It was, okay, to put some numbers on this, just for those of you who say that this can't happen, all right, because I've heard this before. People have said, oh, you can't do that. That would, you know, that would be
you can't happen. You're not going to happen if you don't try.
Well, Chief, it would be the end of America, okay? How many times have you heard that kind of argument, right? All right. 1920, 21.
Don't forget, what about the children, too?
Yeah. What about the children? It was a deflationary crash, all right, from January of 1920, officially marked later on as ended in July of 21. So it was 18 months, all right, basically. Wholesale prices fell 45%.
Well, the Fed...
45! Yeah, and by the way, unemployment peaked at about 12.
Yep.
All right. And the Fed refused to lower rates into this. The Fed was relatively new back then, right? Having started, you know, 7 years earlier. All right. So despite...
They also didn't have any inventory of bonds or stuff to deal with, and they also didn't have the FDIC.
Well, okay. So here's the thing, though. Real output was in real terms, was down a little over 3%, and industrial production down by a third.
Right.
All right. But unlike the tampering that was done later, which, by the way, once Hoover was Treasury Secretary, he was president, he got his way in the next one, when 1929 happened. within 18 months, you were back to full employment, and it was a self-curing problem. The largest expansion in GDP and industrial production at that time, it was called GNP because it was counted differently, the largest expansion in industrial production ever recorded in America.
Well, if you drop occurred. 50 and you come back 100, you're still at the same spot. I mean, you gotta be careful.
Well,
with the
I understand
there.
That, but when have you ever seen a doubling in 18 months?
I think,
right?
there's a huge difference, and I think there's two of them that I study. I mean, and maybe the one in 1890, and others suffered the same way. There's a difference, I think, between a income/business cycle recession, even if it's real severe, and what I call a balance sheet recession, which the 1929 thing was. It's one thing if everybody gets laid off, which, you know, it's not a good thing. That could be a big recession, could be a depression, but when Grandpa Kevin went to the bank to get his $4,000 that he had taken 10
and
years.
It wasn't there.
And it wasn't there. That's a whole different problem. Now he's out of work. And oh, by the way, he's toast. And in his house he just bought is down, you know, 90%. I don't think that in the University of Chicago, they used to beat up on the Fed all the time about the Depression.
I mean, oh, yeah.
If Milton Friedman was here in the room, he'd say, it wasn't the crash of the stock market. It was the idea that they let the money supply drop by 20 or 25% in 18 months, or whatever the hell it was. What I know today, if I was in class, I would raise my hand and say, I don't want to disagree with the you know, the sorcerer here, but the Fed did not have the ability. If they would have somehow found a way, they didn't have the inventory, of essentially buying all those bonds back, which weren't out there, and actually pumping that money into the system, it almost wouldn't have mattered to your grandfather, because without the SIPC, if it didn't get back to him, it didn't do any... They might have actually done the same thing these buffoons are doing now, is they're pumping money into the system that really doesn't need it, and all you're doing is driving prices up. They could have driven the prices maybe back up during the Depression, but nobody could have bought anything.
Right.
They actually had already lost their farm or their savings.
Well, here's the other thing about 2021, okay, is that, you know, so what a lot of people kind of conveniently omit from this is that, of course, 20 was an election year, right? Harding took office in 21.
You keep saying, you're talking about 1920, you keep saying 2020.
Yeah, 19, right. No, I just said 20. I left the
all right, okay,
off.
All right.
Okay. But Harding took office, okay.
Another fine president. That guy, was he like the worst ever or what?
Yeah, well, you know. But one of the things that he did, as soon as he came in office, was he enlarged the tax base. So he changed, you know, one of the fun pieces we got out of, you know, that entire period of time before then was, you know, was income tax. And, you know, this is all part of the 1913 stuff, right? With the Federal Reserve and everything else and income tax, because you got the, you know, you got the 16th Amendment. And the thing that I think is quite interesting about all of this is that there's some question as to exactly how much of this fairly significant spike in federal spending that Harding stuck into the system not only was a significant part of the bounce out of there, but there's a lot of people that would argue that that was essentially what pulled the economy out of there. I would argue no, and simply because changes in monetary and fiscal policy don't take effect instantly. All right,
they claim in the books, back before I can remember, they will claim that the fiscal policy does. We're going to take a little bit of a break here. We haven't one yet. The market is moving. Fiscal policy, if all of a sudden you lowered or raised taxes, for instance, or you started spending more like tomorrow on something, right, sort of like sending people checks during COVID, that hits damn near instantly, where monetary policy takes 6 months. Now, all of that has gone, in my opinion, totally haywire in the last few years, because during the COVID, they poured so much money into the system that the system couldn't even absorb it.
Well, see, Chief, that was one of the things, was that I would argue that has been falsified by the check writing that was done into consumer hands during the COVID.
That's what I'm saying. All this is sort of changing. Hey, let's do a real quick break here because we haven't done one yet.
I got to jump off, guys.
All right, Kevin, Happy New Year, buddy. All right. Guess what? I actually said all good things about you the other night.
Well, that was nice of you to do that. Way to restrain yourself.
Talk about getting into an argument with people. Good Lord. Anyway, thanks, Kevin, for last year. And this year, let's all be like healthy and like do it again and do it be better. SP Futures up 36. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
So you're going to make a lot of money, right?
Look at them yo-yos, that's the way you do it. You play the guitar on the MTV.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe, Matt Byrne on the board. Matt, do you even remember when, like, MTV, all they did was, like, play music and have good-looking girls on it?
That might be a little bit before my time. But you heard the news over in Europe, right?
No.
They shut down all of the actual MTV stations.
Why?
So these are all the stations actually playing the music. They still have their reality TV show, MTV. Yeah.
Well, I mean, this was something. I lived with a couple guys on the South Side. They were mesmerized by that hour after hour. It was better than the internet. No, nothing but good-looking girls and really good music all day. What could go wrong with that?
It's an end of an era.
End of an era. SP Futures up 37. NASDAQ Futures up 238. We got the Dow up 145 over in Europe. Got the DAX up 80.3%. FTSE up 36.3%. CAC around up 36.4%. But moderately bullish over there as well. We have the Nikkei. Let's see. They're not open unless they traded on 1230. Hang Seng is open. They're up 707. That's almost 3%. Shanghai up 3 to call that not much. South Korea's Kospi hits a record high, so they're going high over there in Hang Seng and in South Korea, not so much in Shanghai. And we don't know about Japan. We'll find out tomorrow. Bonds.
up 1 base point, 4.16. The Bunds up 2 base points, 2.88. Oil, which can't seem to get anywhere near $60, is going the other way, 56.91, down 50 cents. Brent down 54 cents, 60.31. Gold with a nice run up here, $40, 43.81. Still nowhere near the 4,500 it almost touched the other day, but still a pretty rarefied height. Silver up 284, 73.44. It touched 80 a couple weeks ago. We've had two, we'll talk about this with Carl when we're done here, we had two increases in margin over at the CME and these products, which caused them to drop both times pretty precipitously. FX, dollar still, euro still over 117. That's the annual drop in a long time, in the last part of last year. The pound still trying to make it to 135, 134.6. We have Bitcoin up $1,200, 89,405. Matt, what do you got for quick traffic, weather, sports, all kinds of sports?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's currently 7:47 a.m. on January 2nd, 2025. Quickly, weather for Chicago, 19 degrees at O'Hare and 21 at Midway. High of 26 with sunny skies today. Low of 18 tonight with mostly cloudy skies. Let's go over to sports real quick. In the NHL yesterday, Blackhawks played Dallas Stars and won 4-3. But on to the big news. NFL this weekend, Sunday, it's the big NFC matchup. Vikings play Packers at 12 p.m. and Bears play at Soldier Field with the Lions at 3:25. Lions are 8-8 this season. Bears 11-5. We'll have to wait and see how that turns out. But yeah, over to you, Chief.
So Carl, it's a lot of stuff that we talk about kind of needs fixing. There's so much chaos. I almost don't even know where to start. I don't know if I want to start at the local level. Hey, guys, stop going through the red lights. Stop going 100 miles an hour. Get rid of the noisy cars. The stuff we talk about, the thing that grabs me the most about the stuff we talk about, the more I really enjoy it, I don't know that anybody has an idea what the hell we're talking about. That disturbs me kind of the most. I mean, imagine having an antitrust conversation at a bar tonight.
Oh, yeah, forget about it. People look at you like you've got six heads.
It's going on so long that it's. I mean, I talked about it a little bit with Larissa last week. It gets to the point where the whole world just accepts that if you're not cheating, you're not trying.
Well, that's a problem.
And that's a problem.
Yeah, and that's. I mean, it. You know, one of the things that I have pointed out repeatedly is I've said several times on the show. One of the primary reasons I left Florida was what Michael showed me. The storm that came into the Panama City area and Port St. Joe and such, what that proved to me was at the core of much of the so-called wonderful GDP that the state of Florida had, and the impact, the involuntary impact that it was imposing upon my wallet and everyone else's, and there was no way to solve it, therefore the only choice was to leave it. Okay, the only sane choice. And essentially it was this. After Andrew, which of course was the really nasty hurricane that came into the area down in Hialeah.
It hit like the area that was probably most susceptible other than like Bangladesh in the world.
Well, yeah, but the thing is the amount of destruction there was for all intents and purposes total. All right. But one of the reasons that the destruction was so severe was that the people who put up stuff down there, they were literally crack shacks. They paid zero attention to building codes.
There were no building codes.
Well, yes, there were, of course, they change over time, right? But there was almost quite literally no attention paid to the rules of any kind.
How far, actually, Noah hear about this, and not that you don't. When I went down to spring break, in 1974, we're talking a ways ago, right?
Yeah.
My aunt, her father had owned some place, a retirement spot down in, what was the name of the town, Homestead?
Yeah.
And I'm Homestead, sitting there. Yeah. Well, I either go, I wasn't much of a beach guy, but I found a spot where he had a great outdoor basketball court with all kinds of good players. I could either go there, play basketball in the morning, go to the track in the afternoon, or I could go down and see my aunt's place in Homestead.
Right.
You know, so I'm thinking, I'll never be able to go home and go to dinner again if I don't go see this place. So I head down there. Carl, I was stunned. I've never seen anything. I mean, I guess I could go somewhere in rural somewhere. These are house after house where everybody's washing machine they ever owned was still on a porch. They literally were 2x4s with plywood with no any kind of stress relief or nothing, with a window air conditioner. And
I'm sick, and people are living here. I mean, I go, Kevin, Carl, we could have, in our younger days, we could have gone from house to house, charged and pushed on the wall and knocked it down.
Well, as I said, it was a crack shack.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, for
this was every one of them.
Oh, yes, I'm well aware of this. Okay. So anyway,
I'm just kind of making the listeners what I ran into.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about like the kind of thing you'd see in Bangladesh.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
I mean, literally was what it was. So anyway, after that storm came through there, it essentially leveled the place, as you would expect would happen if a hurricane hit something like that.
I mean, really, like it nothing up, just down.
Yeah, I mean, all gone.
Yeah.
Right. So after that, the state. Tougher, they said, all right, enough of that crap, okay? and then over the years, of course, in the 2000s, right around the time of the crash.
God, was it hot down there? Was it like 50 miles south of Miami? Good Lord.
Oh, my God, that entire area. You know, now, I mean, January, it's quite nice. In the middle of summer, holy crap, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, then you had that set of storms that came through, including Gene and Charlie and all this, and so there was a second round of this stuff that happened in the early mid 2000s, and the state toughened the codes again. But one of the things that the original round after Andrew mandated that you have hurricane straps on all your roof trusses and on your to keep the decking and the entire roof structure.
Those things a little, they're the same things they use here between the two levels of brick that are hurricane or earthquake suppressors?
No, it's the same concept, but they're different. Okay, so essentially the concept behind this is taking damage from a tree that gets blown down on your roof or what the wind blows as opposed to that the wind blows is difficult or impossible. I mean, obviously, if a Volvo gets picked up and thrown through your wall, there's not a lot you can do to armor a building against that, right? But the idea is to reduce the number of missiles, specifically.
Okay, this is a way to lower the stuff flying around.
Well, your neighbor's roof as an entire roof coming at your house is going to destroy your house.
Or a sailboat that lands.
Yeah, or a sailboat or whatever, right? Yeah. So anyway, this is not just about your building. It's about the debris damage to everything in the area. And so these codes were put in place. Well, in the years after the triplex, after Ivan, then you had the Charlie Gene and all this other stuff, there was another set of codes changes that were added to this on any new construction or re-roofs, which required that your decking, instead of having ordinary felt or synthetic stuff, that you have a secondary barrier laid on there. Now, essentially what that is a butyl rubber sheet that's adhesive on one side that's stuck to the decking. Now, the concept behind this, in addition to keeping the roof on the building with the straps that are supposed to be there, is that if your shingles get stripped by the winds, because you have damage or just old age or whatever have you, wind gets underneath there, tears off, if it manages to get the bottom part of the course lifted, it'll tear the entire thing off, one after another, as it breaks all the seals as it goes. Well, if that happens, and you have that butyl rubber layer there, it doesn't rain inside your house for 8 hours.
Yeah.
All right, so when Michael came through, there were a number of places that I personally saw that had been built after these code changes. And I knew this because I'd lived there for 20 years and I saw them go up. All right. So, you know, here come the bulldozers. And then, you know, then they build these houses. Nice places, new, you know, certainly after these code changes went in. And the roof is in the middle of the street. Not only is there no secondary barrier.
Well, you're supposed
to have
rounded corners and everything.
Only were there no secondary barrier, because all the shingles have been stripped off and you can see the decking, okay, which is not possible if that was there. But secondly, there's no straps. All right? Because, again, you can see this because the entire deconstructed thing is sitting in the middle of the road.
I mean, I'll give you a little bit of an example, and I want to give you the last comment here on the market. And we're planning for the next year. We actually, a few people in the last few weeks, we've leaked them into the XLF. I don't know how long this oil is going to stay at $56, but
You mean XLE?
XLE, yeah. XLF is the other.
But XLF is
financial. You know, in one of the stupid things I do, I was at the Menards or someplace, and I buy this book on foundations and concrete and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I start reading it about how you use concrete block and how you use everything. Well, I've never once seen a house put up the way that book says you're supposed to do it.
Well, of course not. It costs more money.
Yeah, I mean, the concrete block, people use it as brick. They put it together as if it's brick.
And it's not.
And you put a brick layer over it, and they use those little strips like you're talking about.
Right.
But if you do this right, you're supposed to take the rebar
right
all the way through the block and the part that's where the rebar is in, and you're supposed to put concrete in there.
Supposed to pour it.
I've never seen anybody do that.
Well, they didn't do it over in Panama City, and they put their EOC, their Emergency Operations Center, into a building that was built out of that stuff with no reinforcement. And guess what happened to it?
It went right down.
When the hurricane showed up, yeah. The expected thing happened.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
All right, so let's finish
up. By the way,
nobody
went to jail.
All right, well, we talk more on Tuesday, but as I described at the wedding the other night, these are three kind of missiles in the wind here. We don't care about antitrust, so the big companies that we think are too big might actually get a hell of a lot bigger, and they might actually be, you know, some huge percentage of the economy, even more than they are 5 years from now. You got that going for us. We have money pouring into the system already, and we have an administration that seems to think that they're not doing it fast enough, and they're going to put some chump in that spot. I won't say chump, but a guy who's going to do what the doctor...
Oh, go ahead and call it chump.
Yeah, a chump's going to put in and start raising the money supply even more. We're going to lie about the inflation numbers as long as we can, as we're going to start getting more and more people chirping that the numbers are no good. And, oh, by the way, we have huge valuations that on any sort of historical metric are non-justifiable. So, and now the question is, how do you trade in there? And, you know, the weird part, Carl, is our firm, we used to manage money kind of the old-fashioned way, where markets go up and markets go down and all that kind of
right.
stuff. I'm talking about in the 80s,
right.
90s, and we did very well. And we were a little slow to pick up on this. We're only going one way because we're going to inflate the economy. But now that we have picked up on it, we're doing pretty damn good for people. I mean, for me, it's like I can't even believe I'm doing this. But instead of saying somebody's going to come along and correct this stuff, I'm rolling with it. And since I still have puts all the time. So in case somebody turns around, we're gonna do okay. But I'll tell you what, this is nuts. If you just said to me 5 years ago, hey, well, let's see, Chief, you just had this silver 30. Now it's 67. You had a great year for people that were in there. Not everybody's in there. What are you gonna do? I'd say I'd be out of there so fast. you'd have to come after me with a gun to catch me. Now all of a sudden I'm going, I'm hanging on to this. I might just do a little more aggressive call writing or something. But looking at what's going on, how is it not going to keep going up?
Chief, I think it's one of the most dangerous. You're a longtime trader, okay? This is not a new thing for you. That is one of the most dangerous positions to allow to get into your head.
And you know, I know that. That's why I've got these puts.
I know that.
That's why I got these puts in my back pocket.
I'm just saying, you know damn well that this is one of the, how people end up getting screwed.
Without a doubt. But I think you have to agree with me somewhat in that it's not about normal pricing that we and I look at. If these guys go 10% next year on the money supply or 12, I think the market's going to be up, even though it shouldn't be. But it will
I,
be.
All I can tell you is that on a forward basis, when you have multiples here across the market, not just in the places where it's even more stupid, but across the market as a whole, on a forward basis, and you can go back as far as you'd like to look, this is you have never on a 5 and 10 year forward basis been making any kind of reasonable return at all. Anything beyond low single digits.
And you know how much I agree with you, but look at the difference here. The hardest part is you know, we do an awful, I think you know, because you listen all the time and you give a crap about us in the show. You know that we have an awful lot of concentration issues. People
yeah.
give us stock.
Well, everybody does. If
well, I'm saying, but we manage a lot of those.
Yeah, well, you have to.
But a lot of these stocks we are struggling with because they're going down. So what I'm seeing and I'm trying to do here is I never thought this, and this is now how we're doing better, like we're doing real well for people, is that there is a difference between, and this is why we put the protected index program together. There's a difference between the index and the stocks.
Right.
And,
definitely.
I won't name the stocks that we're with concentration issues in, but well, I'll say since the person died, we don't have much of it anymore. We had UPS. Yeah. We managed this for 2 years. The stock was down 40%.
Yeah.
And there's others like that. But what I'm saying is, I'm not so sure that the indexes won't be up, even though, you know, 10 of the 15 stocks that we're managing aggressively as individual stocks aren't going to be down. These guys may, in fact, be the 10 remaining companies or the 20 remaining companies in Weimar, Germany. That's where we're headed.
Well, Chief,
and I don't want to see that. You know, I absolutely don't want to see that.
Yeah, I understand that. But look, I have my prediction thread that I put up right around Christmas, and it's, I do it every year. And in this year, if we have that kind of a year in the indices, I do not get my point. for that prediction, I do not believe that's. I have heard this time it's different so many times.
Last point, and let's kick this around on Tuesday. Like I say, it's always fun to agree with people on Stocks and Jacks because it's really hard to do. The thing that's changed my mind a little bit about all this, Carl, nothing changed my mind about you'll come back to value. You and I are walking down the same street with that. But this watching the depression during COVID and these guys pump the market up that entire time, I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. My world is not this world. This is Weimar world. This is Argentina. This is Turkey world. And we're somehow or another, we're okay with it now. And I don't know why
I'll tell you what the prediction says. To go with the above, the market will finish flat to seriously down, no more than a couple percent up to half or more negative in 2026.
I'm okay with that.
If it doesn't do that, I miss.
Well, about 3 years ago, and it was before, maybe when this guy first took office, Paul. I walk into the local emporium. This guy, one of my buddies, is in there, and I go, he said, "What'd you think of the Fed speech today?" And I go, "Well, I guess if you want to put money in the economy and pump up asset prices in the stock market, it's pretty good." And he looks at me and he goes, "That's exactly what they're supposed to do."
Well, which works until it doesn't.
Well, are people going to get pissed off about not seeing a CPI report? Are people going to continue to get pissed off because they say it's 6.5%?
People get pissed off when they get their card declined at the grocery store.
Yeah. Well, I think the clunker here is, since we still are beholden to people overseas to help finance our place, the clunker here is going to be a 10 or 30 year auction where it's up a point or something, because that's what happened way back.
Well, yeah, that won't happen. What will happen is they'll pull it, but there's your signal that bad things happen.
That's the thing I think we really have to watch out for.
Yeah, I think if you have an auction that gets pulled, that would be the alarm bell going off for sure.
I also think that somewhere this from its top, according to Russell, these cryptocurrencies are down $1 trillion. If they drop another trillion, if there's an issue in there, I think that caused the problem too. But I don't know how.
I think that the start of that is already on.
Me too. I can't quantify it. You're my maven there. I don't know.
I think that entire so-called asset class is. I mean, good God, it's digital tulips, and you don't even get something pretty.
We have the huge drop, and now it's in this no man's land for how long now? 2 months,
right?
But what is that? Is that the eye of the hurricane, or what is it?
Oh, that's just technicals. That's all it is. And I mean, I hate technical analysis from that standpoint. But on the other hand, why do people do it? Because it does tell them something, right? I mean, it's like anything else.
According to the Chicago people, back when I was in school, it tells you what happened. It never told you what will happen.
Well, but if you look at the chart, if you look at Bitcoin...
By the way, those guys are all dead, Carl, so you can feel free to...
Well, I get that. But you know what? It's sitting on a shelf that it tested that to fill a gap that it, that you know had been there from a couple of from about a year and a half ago. It held there. Now it's sitting on the shelf again. Well, if it breaks, I mean, I can look at this chart and I can tell you where I think it heads. I think you're talking about a something of. Bitcoin, the next real support level is somewhere between 40 and 60.
Well, I also am concerned
that's
about...
That's a hell of a dive from
If I owned Bitcoin, I'd be concerned about all of a sudden gold and silver are the new phenomenons. And that, they were on the back shelf for a while, and Bitcoin was...
Well, but see, when people lose confidence in something, that's what happens. They look for somewhere else for it to go, right?
Well, Happy New Year, buddy. We had a lot of fun this year. We've got... I can't get over some of the good stuff we talked about. I think Larissa's been a massive increase in knowledge between what she teaches and what like Hal and Russell, because she's more towards every person putting their estates together and stuff, and the connection she makes between what we talk about and what's going on that level, I think really helped the show. And
and by the way, just as a quick flash, it just popped up. I'll take the 5 seconds and give it to you. Tesla reported their deliveries for the fourth quarter down 16%, and the stock's up.
Stock's up $8. Yeah.
Now tell me how that makes any sense.
I don't know. I mean, it's you talk about we haven't talked about is governmental money. If there wasn't any of those things to buy electric cars and they didn't get all that dough, what would this stock be trading? 12?
Well, I'm just saying, but the subsidies are gone now.
How much would Elon be worth instead of a trillion? It'd be worth a billion, maybe?
Not a lot. He'd be lucky if that company wasn't out of business. Yeah.
Anyway, buddy, Happy New Year. Matt,
you too.
Nice job this year. Happy New Year to you as well. S&P Futures up 36, NASDAQ Futures up 234. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex. Offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit hamzyanalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much.